The 1972 World Science Fiction Convention, I had just had my first comic book published by Ken Kruger, and that was the story about the monster from the sewers, the turd. The turd came about me seeing people who really were making incredibly complicated, beautiful costumes that looked like they'd worked all year on. And my question was, I wonder what they'd do if somebody came up in a costume that they created in the last 5 minutes. I turned 21 that weekend, so to show my maturity, I drove down to the Smart and Final wholesale store and bought 3 6-pound tubs of peanut butter, chunky peanut butter, a pair of legs hosiery for women, a toilet plunger, and just to make the effect realistic, a can of corn niblets. And I went back to my room and covered myself with peanut butter. I used the hosiery to create like a mask that went over my head so I could breathe, so I could put the stuff all over me. Oh, and I also put like bits of toilet paper hanging all over it. Well, I never realized that this stuff would melt. And I couldn't see where very well either. And I'm bumping up against people in their costumes, and I'm leaving a trail of melted peanut butter. Well, I entered the contest, and they created a new category for me, most revolting. And I was very proud of that. Well, about 2 weeks later, all the plumbing in the hotel exploded. I mean, just all over. And they came back to the convention. I guess it had been the last big convention there. They said, the pipes are full of peanut butter. And they charged the convention thousands of dollars to pay for the damages. So to this day, at the World Science Fiction Conventions, which still occur every year someplace, no edible costumes.
Hello again, and welcome to Comic-Con Begins, origin stories of the San Diego Comic-Con and the rise of modern fandom. A SiriusXM original podcast, hosted by me, your cosplay Scream Queen scientist and foundational con member, Brink Stevens. If you haven't heard episode 1, make sure to go back and start there. There's a lot to cover in our pop culture tale, and I don't want you to miss a thing. Conventions had been running since the 1930s, and they went hand in hand with niche zines and magazines like Fori Ackerman's Famous Monsters of Filmland. These periodicals, along with comic books, helped shape the young minds we met in Episode 1. Meanwhile, the moon landing in 1969 was profoundly inspiring to us all. Rock and roll had entered our ears and minds, and none of us were untouched by the churning social and political storms that were raging around the country and globe.
In the late 60s, there's a lot of counterculture movements happening with the wars, the protests against Nixon, the stuff over in Europe, Kent State. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of tumultuous times, and we came a few years after that. But, you know, it resonated down throughout the country, but certainly in California was a big deal. But we had a really good group of underground comic artists who actually lived in San Diego that really brought home that Berkeley spirit. So when we went to those early Bay Cons in the early 70s, this was really a chance to see things more up close and personal. It was a short drive around to go to Berkeley, to go to San Francisco, to go to Oakland, to look at the burned out buildings, to look at, you know, people protesting and the signs.
So if you think about just the mass numbers of kids that were born in the post-World War II baby boom, that was significant. Advertisers had to think, how are we going to appeal to this gigantic youth market? And then there were, of course, the people who their numbers were not quite so vast, but they were still kids themselves. The people who did Mad Magazine, people like George Clayton Johnson, the counterculture that was happening with the Beat Generation, and just the fact that, you know, teenagers are going to go their own way anyway. Oh, and, you know, and toss in the war in Vietnam.
I think we were trying to become part of this society, not necessarily the global society, but rather the society of creators, of to my mind, still very perceptive and intelligent people who were doing things that other people were not. And that was the part of adult society that we wanted to be part of. And yes, they were a different part than the regular 9-to-5 society. But nonetheless, we didn't feel that we were trying to escape that adult generation. No, we were actually trying to become part of it and to incorporate ourselves into it.
Conventions were an opportunity for people who lived in these, all these scattered around, to get together and conspire, to breathe together in the same room, sometimes to breathe certain things in the same room. The conventions are like, I'll use an example from the great world of the Grateful Dead. The Shakedown Street and the scene surrounding the Grateful Dead, this wonderful band who I love that saw many times. But there are people who follow them around the country and get together. The scene before and after the show was as important, or maybe more, than the show itself. And Comic-Con and the science fiction conventions that were occurring around the country are like that.
The whole personal computer revolution happened a few years after Comic-Con. Again, with this notion that people can do stuff that had never been done before. And so I think we were part of that whole zeitgeist, the whole spirit of the age.
What seems on the surface to be a technology of isolation may in fact be a medium for reintroducing the individual to the needs and pleasures of community involvement.
It was a time of such huge change. And especially after the 50s being so conformist, and then Kennedy was elected, and here's this beautiful, youthful couple after, you know, the kind of stodgy yet heroic Eisenhower administrations, and let us not forget Joseph McCarthy and all of that kind of stuff.
One communist on the faculty of one university is one communist too many.
And so we have all of this hope, and then this beautiful, youthful Camelot is destroyed with a bullet in Dallas.
Three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
And it was like everyone looked like, you know, they had been slammed into the wall, you know, like the world had ended. But from this emerged what one of my writing teachers said: everything changed in 1964. It was like somebody pulled out the plug or plugged something in, but by 1966, things were really moving.
American youth today has its fringes, but that's part of the greatness of our country. I have great faith in American youth. The youth of today can change the world, and if they understand that, I think that we're going to go forward to a great age, not just for Americans, but for peace and progress for all the people in the world.
In 1974, when Nixon is about to leave office, as sort of a side activity for promoting the Comic-Con this year, myself and Igor Goldkind launched an organization called Youth of the President. And we wanted to see if we could get on local media defending Nixon with completely ridiculous arguments.
So there was a meeting, a Comic-Con meeting one time at San Diego State. And then the meeting was over and Igor and Barry were still like wandering around San Diego State. And they got the idea to wander into KPBS, which was the public radio station there on campus. So they went in there and said, oh, hey, we're with Youth for Nixon. The radio station thought that was interesting enough that they decided to interview them.
And we did a series of shows, and I think we did one probably right around the time of the Comic-Con. And we were on the shows of some very famous local people. One was a local talk show host, a revered local talk show host named Harold Keen. Igor was on that one. I was behind the scenes for that. And Igor said that we were going around to elementary schools defending Nixon, and he showed a card drawn in crayon of Nixon that said, we like our president. Our president is a good man. This is, of course, something I created.
It's at the height of Watergate. And so Nixon was not popular at the time. And he's not especially not popular among the youth. Of course, they weren't supporters at all. They were just I don't know how old Igor was at the time. He was probably 14. And you know, Barry was a few years older.
On one show, when we were pinned down about our nonsensical beliefs, Igor said, all we know is what we believe.
I guess they made such an impression that the people at KPBS said, well, we have a talk show on the air in a couple of days. Why don't you come back and you can be guests on it? So I'm listening to the two of them on the air, and they're just like making up stuff as they go along.
At one point, Lawrence Gross, who was a local talk show host and later television personality, said, don't you think that Richard Nixon has to operate within the boundaries of society, within the constitutional boundaries? And Igor said, and I had prompted him to say this, maybe it's best to make an analogy for a minute. Now, we see the country as like a big boat, and Richard Nixon's the captain, and he's trying to steer the boat, and the boat is in the middle of a raging storm, and it's rocking back and forth, and there's this terrible storm. And in the middle of this storm, the American people and the press have the audacity to come up to the captain and ask, what time is lunch going to be served? And then there's a pause, and Gross says, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. What does that mean?
And it's like a half-hour show or something. They're pulling this gag. They had heard that Nixon was going to resign, and then Gerald Ford would become president. He would pardon Nixon, and then he would name Nixon to be his vice president. Then Ford would resign, and Nixon would become president again. He'd be pardoned. And I remember the host saying, no, 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 that's not possible. You can't do that. And I think I called in and said, oh, yeah, I've heard the same rumor.
Well, at one point, we said that Nixon really hadn't resigned. It was an audio animatronic figure. And we actually got to say this on the radio. You know, we were 15 and 17 years old, and we got a big kick out of this. And you know, if Nixon hadn't quit, we wanted to go all the way on to go on, like, the Tom Snyder show. And I think we could have done it, but that bum Nixon quit, and we couldn't keep it going.
People are gullible. Even reporters are gullible. They'll go after a story. And a lot of it is about appearance, because they could call up. They're persuasive. They could talk to people and make them believe them and believe that they were sincere. And a lot of the media then, even in the 70s, was becoming more about the show of media or news as opposed to the actual content or truthfulness.
This is what happens when you fill kids' heads up with comic books and science fiction. They start blurring the lines of reality and Hunter Thompson, and they start doing stuff like this. So this is the wages of comic book fandom right there.
The San Diego convention opened yesterday, and already it's in high gear. Superheroes are everywhere, but so are customers. And that's one major reason for the convention, share and share alike. For a profit, of course. If a 1946 issue of...
We didn't know that we couldn't do it. We were going through adolescence when a lot of people seemed to be either fighting back or being given permission to misbehave or to go against the grain. I think it was, you know, kind of a thrill to see, you know, how you could piss off the adults by just, you know, coloring outside the lines. So that might have had something to do with it. Here you have a bunch of kids who seem to be given permission to do this, and in a really big way.
We were all surfing this forward wave of geek culture, this thing that was starting to coalesce and starting to bring in people from all around the world who had never really had a chance to interact, because the closest they got prior to this was either going maybe to a local group, a local fan club that usually meets at a library or somebody's house once a week. But all of a sudden you had these conventions where you'd have hundreds and then thousands of people like-minded for yourself. It's the oldest trope in the world, but context really is everything. And the context of the late 60s, well, let's say from about 65 to 66 to about 75, 76, it was honestly a short period of time, but it seemed like it went on forever.
Really a time of immense cultural change, controversy. The war sparked all kinds of controversies and drove a line of cultures between the young and the old. So there was an us or them aspect.
You have this explosion of liberation throughout America and the world, and it's mostly generational. There used to be this old saying, never trust anyone over 30. And people proudly wore buttons like that. I had one. All of these groups were under the same umbrella. We were all young. We all had long hair. We all rejected the status quo, and we're all going to change the world.
Well, we weren't hippies, but we were hip. We wanted to be. We were high school students, so we wanted to be. And we had dress codes, which we were rebelling against. So, let us wear blue jeans at school. It doesn't seem very meaningful, but that was an issue.
Richard Alf was the first student at Kearney High to grow his hair out. And that really upset the administration of the school. So they came to him and told him one day, they said, hey, if you don't cut your hair, we're going to suspend you. So he got his grandfather to write a letter to the school saying that they were interfering with Richard's constitutional rights. And if they did not redress this issue to their satisfaction, they were going to sue the school and blah, blah, blah. And so all of a sudden the school got worried. So they decided to come up with a trial for Richard. You can imagine how it went, and they ended up voting that Richard had to cut his hair. So he cut his hair, but he immediately grew it out again. And after that, they didn't hassle him again, because I think they had to save face, they had made a big deal out of it. And then the next year, when I ended up at Kearney, then I was the first kid, in my class to have long hair. But I didn't have any problem with it, because Richard had already paved the way for that.
So even though, for instance, that same week that the astronauts landed on the moon for the first time, within that same month was when David Bowie's Space Oddity came out.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
It was all part of a continuum for us. So I can't say that any one particular song or any one particular album was more influential than any other. It was all part of this tremendous creative milieu that was all happening at the same time. And we were very fortunate to be there when that was all happening.
Here we were, just teenagers, doing what we like to do. Yeah, there was a certain aspect of we were going against the grain, but we didn't care. And we weren't breaking the law. Or maybe we were by some people's standards, but, because of the underground comic things and, oh my God, there's a penis on that page.
At some point or another, underground comics came into the mix. So you had people like Dan O'Neill, Trina Robbins, Baba Ron Turner. You had all these people from the underground, George DiCaprio. He and his son would come to the convention. You may have heard of his son.
One night I'm running projectors at the film room, and he comes in and he says to me, hey, could you watch my kid for a while? We've got a party going on upstairs. And I said, yeah, George, I'll keep an eye on him, make sure he stays in the room. And he says to his son, now, Leo, you be good for this guy. Now, that guy, of course, was Leonardo DiCaprio, but he's like, 7 or 8 years old at this point. But, fun things that happened at Comic-Con years and years ago.
I remember going through the hallways with Dan O'Neill and a bottle of whiskey, and he was playing his banjo. And somebody was passing around dope, and the security for the convention kept on telling the security for the hotel that we were on a different floor than the floor that we were at. And then we'd go to a different floor. No, they're down on the fourth now. Dan O'Neill was an extremely brilliant underground cartoonist. He's the one who started the Air Pirates Funnies and got sued by Disney. And so during the early days of the convention, they would hand out these little sheets of paper, almost like a Post-it, and they'd have you draw a picture of the mouse, for the Mouse Liberation Front. And you're supposed to sign it with your Mouse Liberation Front number, not your name.
They've made a lot of changes to copyright law in the years since. But they basically did these two issues of this comic, some of which included Disney characters who they assumed were in the public domain, doing things that Disney characters would not normally do because it was an underground comic. There was some drug use. There was more exploration of the relationship between Mickey and Minnie, for instance, and perhaps a couple of the others. So they got themselves into some big trouble, and they went through a very long lawsuit about that. And I know it's still a sore point. I follow Bobby London on Facebook, and he complains about how he was screwed over in that deal all the time. So there are definitely people who are still feeling the punch.
Hello, my name is Robert Crum, and this is my wife, Aileen. We're underground cartoonists.
On the surface, our life appears to be really quaint and charming.
Yes, doesn't it? But underneath, it's a steaming cauldron of sexual perversion, drugs, and twisted neurosis.
I was less interested in the mass media, let's say cartoon art, than something that really pushes at the edges.
I wound up starting out doing underground comics. You know, my first comic was one that Ken Kruger had published. He actually put his money where his mouth was and hired John Pound and I to do this underground comic for him. I think I got $10 a page. But you know what? Doesn't matter. He put money in my hand and he bought the originals on top of that. He gave me like an extra $50 for the pages. I was very proud of that, and no matter how offensive the story may have been. Remember, Marvel was doing a lot of these monster comics, so it was kind of my takeoff on that, except my monster came out of the sewer, and he was a monster made out of shit called the Turd. Very deep stuff there. It was about as juvenile as you could get, but at least I got into print.
I see it my own way, and I feel in doing that, I become an individual. If I played piano my own way, I'd be an individual, and I feel that I'd have some enriching quality. And I like that. I like to have some enriching quality. It makes me feel good. Some people don't like to have enriching qualities, see? And they just go about doing whatever they're doing in business or something else, and they do well at it, and they accept it. But I don't accept that. In fact, I don't accept anything. I fight anything that comes along.
Underground comics came along to fill a void. There were people who still loved the idea of comic books, but they didn't want to read things that were basically aimed at 10-year-olds. And undergrounds did a lot of that. Eventually, the business matured as all media matured.
In fact, the whole comic industry almost went away in the 1950s. There was a book written called Seduction of the Innocent by a psychologist, Dr. Frederick Wortham.
In this comic book is a love story, a boy and girl in love. They get married, and after an offensively lurid description, illustrated, of course, of the couple's wedding night, the book shows how the bride murders her husband by chopping his head off with an axe. This comic book describes a sexual aberration so shocking that I couldn't mention even the scientific term on television. I think there ought to be a law against them. Tonight I'm going to show you why.
And he laid the blame for juvenile delinquency on monkey see, monkey do when kids read comics. That never happened, not on a large scale, but he created the paranoia over that. In the 50s, people were burning comics. You know, like they burned Beatles records in the 60s. and it was sad. They put comics out of business that were too radical. And all the comics publishers got together and said, we don't want Congress to regulate us. We got to create a comics code. We created our own comics code. And we put a stamp on the book. And by 1960, most comics had this comics code approved stamp on it, which meant you couldn't have zombies and you couldn't have blood and death was really kind of off limits. They put a lot of, you know, self-imposed restrictions on the content as editors because they were paying for it and they wanted to stay in business. And humor comics like Casper the Friendly Ghost, Harvey Comics, Richie Rich Comics, Archie Comics, those were fine. They had no problem. But the superhero comics, war comics, Western comics, all subjected to the comics code. And that went away in the 1980s when they had a direct market. Publishers could sell directly to comic book stores. And that created a whole new market away from the distributors who would only distribute a book with the comics code on it. And by then, the country had moved on.
Gradually, underground comics and alternative press things became more mainstream. People felt less threatened by them. They were more accepted. There was no discrepancy between liking Karl Barks and Robert Crumb.
Part of the overlay of the culture in America in that period of time was permissiveness. It was a liberal atmosphere. It was the birth of what we would now think of as modern feminism, gay rights movement, any kind of trans or LGBTQ plus, that was all starting up. Anti-war fervor, which was really the glue that held everyone together because everyone hated that war in Vietnam. And I, as the son of a military professional who then went into military intelligence and grew up in the Philippines, I, as a boy and as a teenager, grew up seeing the damage early on. And my father, being in military intelligence, of course, was close-lipped, but our daily life was informed by what was really happening in the Third World and within American government and within the American bureaucracy. So in a sense, I don't want to use the word wised up, but in a sense, I was getting a lot more information than your person on the street was getting in America at that time. So when I came back to America in the late 60s, it was just like, wow, look at this. It was like a giant candy store. And our generation was the one that was out in the streets getting our heads cracked open, tear gas, thrown in jail. It was a very militant time. And that, in a sense, was the boomers' gift to the next generation. The boomers also had a lot to answer for. But all of that came together in the Comic-Con.
It is time for an honest look at the problem of order in the United States. Dissent is a necessary ingredient of change. But in a system of government that provides for peaceful change, there is no cause that justifies resort to violence. Let us recognize that the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence. So I pledge to you, we shall have order in the United States.
In the beginning of 1971, I was drafted into the Army, and I became a combat infantryman. Yeah, 73, I came back from Vietnam just before the convention, and I was in events in the Central Highlands surrounded by the North Vietnamese Army. We blew up our ammunition dump. A lot of serious things happened. And then suddenly, I was home, and I was at the convention, and there were all of my friends. And my sergeant, it turned out, I wanted a pass for the whole thing so I could go to Comic-Con. And when I told him that, it turned out he was a big Ray Bradbury fan. And I said, Ray Bradbury is going to be there. He says, really? Can you get me Ray Bradbury's autograph? I said, I can get you Ray Bradbury's autograph. Okay. And he really wrote me a nice 5-day pass. And I drove to San Diego. And so I told Ray the story, and he signed a hardback copy of Fahrenheit 451. And he wrote the most beautiful full page inscription to my sergeant. And when I brought that back to him, I never got put on another crap detail after that. Ray Bradbury helped me get along with my platoon sergeant. So that was a very good thing. But yeah, you know, the real world intruded in this, our vision, and things have worked out differently than what we expected. But that shouldn't be surprising.
During the time I was in the Army and everything, I ended up at People's Park in the demonstration up there in Berkeley. And that was just on a weekend. And I came back to the base and they wanted to bring charges against me. And the idea that I was a conscience objector, and they didn't seem to realize that. They wanted to put me on guard duty, and it just wasn't going to happen, you know. And I would no sooner pick up a gun than train myself to be a fucking assassin. I'm sorry. You know, that the idea that there's just no way. I just do not believe in this violence, you know, and I always have accepted that. And I've had to fight my way just to be who I am, you know, and the idea that that's not right. You shouldn't have to, every foot you step in this life, profess that you believe in peace. Military service is still affecting me. You know, it never ended. You know, they changed me. You know, there's just no other way around that. You know, the bureaucracy itself, the institution of the military will change you, not just combat.
I was different. That event changed my life, of course.
And I got out of the Army, and then I ended up at I met an illustrator, Linda Trujillo, who invited me to an art party with Roger and Elizabeth Penny. And at that party, I ended up meeting John Pound, Richard Alf, Jack Dickens, Scott Shaw. Roger and Elizabeth put on parties for 2 years and then ended. And then I started putting on art parties.
And it was during these parties that I got to meet all the local cartoonists in San Diego, in the San Diego area. I met Scott Shaw, Dave Scroggie, and especially Shel Dorff, who was became a good friend and kind of a mentor to me. And he's the one who got me involved in the Comic-Con.
A few years later, a lot of the underground artists from San Francisco started coming down. I've been a cartoonist my whole life and read comics my whole life. And so that's how I connected with the Comic-Con. I was sitting around my house one day, and we were having a little party in the back of my house. In the front of the house was my studio. And my ex-sister-in-law had always had a hard time keeping her clothes on. And she was dancing on the coffee table in our back room. And a knock came on the door, and I peeked out the door.
Of course, we're paranoid already from smoking the weed and on top of the laws of the time. We're like, holy crap, it's the cops. But Jim's a pretty cool guy. He goes to the door, and it's Shel Dorff. And Shel Dorff comes in, and he has this little man behind him that looks like he's working for the government. He's wearing a suit. This is like on a Friday or Saturday night, about 9 o'clock at night. And here comes this little, and he acts like droopy. It's like, this is my friend Joe. Hello, folks. You know, I mean, it's not, he didn't make this big Stan Lee kind of entrance. And instead of just saying, this is Joe Shuster, I thought he'd like to meet some local cartoonists, which is what any sane person would do. Shel starts acting like we're on some sort of game show. And he's going, you know, Joe's a cartoonist too. Well, that's great, Joe. And of course, we're all mentally thinking, Joe, please leave. Please leave. I'd like to talk to this surfer girl for a while. And, no, Shel just keeps going. The one thing I remember, the last one, was he said, well, he designed a very famous logo with pop-out letters. And I or somebody said, Shel, would you just tell me who he is? Yeah, I mean, we're acting like Joe isn't even there at that point because it's just Shel trying to do his own Shel Dorff spiel. And, of course, it's Joe Shuster. Joe Shuster was one of the most important men in the history of comics in that he was the co-creator of Superman. And he drew the strip for many years until it became so popular, he had to hire assistants to take it over. And his eyesight was declining significantly. So I think the last work he did in comics was probably in the mid-50s. And at that point, we're really like, wow, because we knew exactly who he was. But at the same time, we still wanted to get rid of him. And in my back of my mind, I'm thinking, and I've had this happen more than once, I would have killed to meet so-and-so, why do I want him to leave me alone now? And they got the message. We didn't have to be mean to him, fortunately, but it was kind of, I think, I don't know exactly how it happened, but they got the message and got out of there.
Less and less in movies and television were we seeing pure golden heroes, John Wayne, perfect, no flaws, the American way characters. And naturally in comic books, because they aped movies and television so much, we were seeing more and more flawed superheroes, misunderstood superheroes, heroes for whom the powers and the responsibility of saving others was a burden as opposed to maybe a blessing.
Doom is a very tragic figure. Doom has got a lot of class. I like Doom. Doom has got a lot of class. He's got a lot of cool, but Doom has one fallacy. He thinks he's ugly, see? And he's afraid to take that mask off. And he knows, you know, Doom is an extremist. He's a paranoid. He thinks in extremes, you know. He can't think, well, I've got a star on me, but that doesn't make me, you know, repellent. Actually, Doom is a very handsome guy with a star on him that he got from acid when he was a child. But Doom is an extremist. He's a paranoid. To him, he's extremely ugly. If Doom were to lose one hair, he'd put on a wig. See? And if Doom had an enemy, he'd have to wipe him out.
And if Doom thought that anybody was smarter than himself, he'd kill him. Because Doom would have to be the smartest man in the world. He's an extremist. But, you know, he has good manners.
You know, there was a tendency all the time to look for the dark side of heroic figures. People don't like that in some cases. I have mixed feelings about it, but it did fit in more with the era we were living in. We less put absolute, unvarnished faith in our leaders. We now tend to question them much more. Even the ones we follow, we tend to see as flawed and human and capable of error or capable of weaknesses or human weaknesses. And comic books were just reflecting the times, I think.
I made a T-shirt that was a response to that whole wave of the smiley face button. And had a big yellow smiley face, except the smiley face had this horrible, you know, leer on its face, and it had fangs, and it was saying, fuck off. It just said, fuck off across the top. Because everything was like, oh, let's just be happy. It's like, no, it was 1973. Everything wasn't happy. But anyway, I'm wearing this thing, and Bob Clampett is walking around the exhibit hall. And, or as we called it in those days, the dealer's room. And he stops, and I recognized who he was because he looked just like Roy Orbison. And I was kind of gushing, and all he was interested in was my shirt. He says, where can I get one of those? I said, well, I made this. He goes, well, can I buy it from you? And I said, oh, I'm not selling you anything, Bob Clampett, but if you want it, you can have it. He goes, yeah, when can I get it? Can I have it right now? And I said, I said, who are you mad at? He goes, no, I just think it's funny. I want to wear it around the convention. Okay. So I peeled it off. And he put it on over his shirt, but I didn't really have a shirt, so I just went over and bought like a Freak Brothers shirt from somebody. But the rest of the day, Bob's strutting around there with fuck off on his chest. It's just like one of the most respected guests we ever had.
Bobby Kennedy's dead. Eldridge Cleaver's gone. The Yippies are nothing anymore. Huey Newton's not locked behind bars anymore, but he's locked in a penthouse apartment. We don't have a Eugene McCarthy or a Martin Luther King anymore. You see, we don't really have anybody. They're all gone. Some radicals and discontented liberals have turned to spiritual involvement as an alternative to political involvement with the hope of rising or raising consciousness in order to raise the culture, change the lifestyles, or generally make people realize that their way is better. Jesus freaks, Hare Krishna, occult, communes, this sort of thing. More still have resigned themselves to the fact that nothing's going to change, so why fight? Why not just find some little niche in society and live there? Or exist there?
When we return, we'll find out what happened when those of us who loved science fiction were confronted by the Super Trek fans that seemed to be taking over our convention. Or were they?
Got anything to say, Dr. Lurie?
How do you feel, Sam?
I feel beautiful.
Great.
I want to thank Joanna and Mr. Milano and all my friends who helped me get out, and at those who didn't help, I want to be reassuring. It's all going to work out all right. And in particular, I want to send a message of support to Andrei Sakharov, who's doing the same thing in Russia.
Great job, guys. Hey.
Wendy did a lot of things, but the most interesting thing she ever did, which I'm sure she's told you, is about babysitting Timothy Leary, which I would have liked to have babysat Timothy Leary, but we wouldn't have ever gotten back to the convention.
I mean, little did I know when I saw Timothy Leary talking on television that I was going to be on a date with him, you know, a few years later.
Timothy Leary was an academic, I believe at Harvard, who began investigating the prospects, the potentials of psychedelic drugs to improve the mind. And he turned into something of a guru and an exponent of the value of LSD. He's the man that coined the phrase, tune in, turn on, and drop out. I think I've got that in the right order. And he was identified as the number one Pied Piper for psychedelic drugs in the 60s. And he ran afoul of the law, I think it was on a charge of marijuana, fled the country, was put in prison, and was in a correctional facility in downtown San Diego during the Comic-Con years, the early Comic-Con years.
Timothy Leary was just being released from federal prison in downtown San Diego the week before the convention. And I said, great, we can construct a panel on the future. And everyone at the convention committee was very excited by this. I mean, he was obviously a huge celebrity, whether you bought into his message or not. And it was considered a real feather in Comic-Con's cap to have him join us. Until Shel Dorff talked to Russ Manning, a top cartoonist, illustrator of Tarzan mainly. He also wound up doing the first Star Wars newspaper strip. So Russ was a truly top talent and a great supporter of the Comic-Con. He was also very conservative politically. He called up Shel Dorff, mad as a wet hen, and said if somebody like Timothy Leary was going to be a guest at Comic-Con, that he was pulling out. And not only that, he was calling up all his other old-time cartoonist friends and encouraging them to pull out too. Shel is going off about this. We have to rescind our invitation to Timothy Leary. And he was so abrasive and smug about it that I could see that my friend John was having to physically restrain himself from reaching around from the back seat and grabbing Shel by the throat and strangling him. We did wind up resolving it in a very sensible and simple fashion. We didn't make Timothy Leary an official guest. We just presented him anyway.
He was sitting by the pool of the El Cortez. That was the first time that I actually met him, and I didn't realize who he was. He had those eyes, those charismatic eyes, and they were sky blue. But it's like we locked eyes, and I was like, oh my God, I'm in trouble, because he was just so fascinating, and I could not stop listening. So of course I wanted to go to dinner. And so the coordinates for meeting were behind the back of the El Cortez. And he drove up in this beat up old car, and there was nobody else in the car, and there was nobody else waiting with me. And so he said, is it okay if it's just us? And I thought, okay, well, I think I can handle myself. You know, the most notorious man in America, labeled by Richard Nixon, no less. But we ended up at this place called the Old Spaghetti Factory. This was when it was a warehouse in San Diego. It was really cool place, very dark and inviting and kind of romantic and kind of funky. And no one had any reason to recognize him. He didn't really look like, you know, the pictures people might have remembered on the Huntley Brinkley report. So we were left alone to just eat this dinner. But then he started talking to me in a way that I can only say was like I completely understood why so many college students had followed him. And he said, so Miss Sweet and 20, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out right now. I'm at college. You know, Comic-Con has had this amazing effect on me. And he said, you don't know how lucky you are to be your age, because anything you want is yours. All you have to do is reach your hands out and just take it. And so we went back to smoke by the pool with everybody. Everybody was getting high by the pool. And George Clayton Johnson kind of had the room, so to speak. And his wife, Lola, was sitting on one of the lounge chairs. Timothy Leary and I went and sat with her. And we all three of us were all cuddled up, hugging together and getting high while George was talking about Logan's Run. You know, it was just another day at Comic-Con. I don't know how else to explain it. And other people were all having their own amazing parallel experiences at that time, but that was kind of mine.
I have to say that our dear friend Wendy All is so right in not only recounting her outrageous outing with Timothy Leary, but also in suggesting her enlightening experience was merely one of many we were all having. Personally, becoming a fixture in the Con's long-running costume showcase, The Masquerade, is the enlightening experience I always come back to. An acolyte of Fourier Ackerman myself, it was no wonder that when I decided to enter the 1974 Con's Masquerade event, I put together and wore an outfit that paid tribute to his superheroine, Vampirella. When I won the Masquerade, I was only 19 years old, and already being tasked to take my costuming passion and skills to the next level by becoming the coordinator of the event. Before this, I wanted to become a marine biologist and was on my way to a PhD. I was attending Scripps Institute and focusing my energies on the science behind what I hoped would be a breakthrough in communication with dolphins. Like so many others involved in the Con in those early days, I was certainly a nerd, inspired throughout my life as I was by sci-fi books, comics, fantasy stories, and hard science. Who knew that my side interest in costuming and running the Masquerade would so dramatically shift the trajectory of my life? Thanks to my involvement in the Masquerade, producers in the audience took note, and I soon began my never-ending film career. Before I knew it, this young science buff on her way to becoming a marine biologist was suddenly acting in movies, transforming me into the original Scream Queen, starring in such cult classics as Slumber Party Massacre. As it turned out, Wendy's encapsulation of the Con as a series of amazing experiences we were having throughout the days at the El Cortez is particularly apt for another longtime Con contributor, the leading force behind the Con's own parody band, the All Human Orchestra. Take it away, Roger Friedman.
For many years, kind of my main involvement as part of the entertainment for every year's Masquerade was we became the musical entertainment that only appeared at Comic-Con, no other times, with me as the lead singer. The name of the group was actually borrowed from a 1940s outfit, which was the All-Girl Orchestra, well, an orchestra in which all the participants were women. So we became Dr. Raoul Duke and his All-Human Orchestra. And the name Raoul Duke, of course, is stolen from Hunter S. Thompson. That was the pseudonym under which he originally published Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas when it appeared in Rolling Stone magazine.
And as far as I can tell, all the members of the band were at least partially human. So it wasn't terribly incorrect advertising. But for several years after that, what we would do was we would perform popular songs at Comic-Con and just change the lyrics to be more appropriate for the comic book and science fiction audience.
And so we wrote a parody of Valley Girl. We didn't know this, but one of the people there, I don't think he was a guest, I think he just came out with Marvel's people, was Marvel editor Jim Shooter. Jim Shooter was a guy that had gotten into comics when he was a teenager and had worked his way up to becoming the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. Anyway, we perform one of our songs, and one of the parts of the lyrics is about, you know, oh, I want to buy that comic because it has such a great cover. Oh, geez, I open it up and it's all inked by Vince Coletta, which was a typical gripe you always heard in the comic shops at that time. We did it. Everybody laughed. We got a lot of applause, and they were back to the rest of the show, and Jim Shooter storms backstage. I mean, it looked like Frankenstein was after us, and he gets right down in our faces, I mean literally, starts screaming at us that we have ruined Vince Coletta's career. Why? Because Vince Coletta was sitting next to him at the show, and we never said he was bad. We just kind of repeated what everybody used to say, and we were joking. Some people in comics have a very short fuse.
And we also did some other not exactly musical performances as well. What we did as the All-Human Orchestra was just do theater on stage. And at that point, it was all connected with the Saturday Night Masquerade, which, by the way, that was where you saw people doing cosplaying.
You know, growing up around the Con, from such an early age, the cosplay, it just seemed perfectly normal to me. For some people, it shifted more away from guys just super happy to have another excuse to wear a Halloween costume, or as an adult to be able to dress up as your character and not be shamed because you're asking for candy dressed as Gandalf and you're 40, right? So I think it really is an outlet for adults to be able to do that in a safe environment.
Everyone at Comic-Con speaks a language that we all can kind of understand in a way, and you can make jokes there that no one else would understand in the real world. And I remember being in an elevator and there was a guy dressed up as the Flash in the elevator. And no knock on this, but he had a few extra pounds on him, and God bless him. He looked great out there. And he got off the elevator, and these two nerds next to us in the elevator laughed to themselves and said, "Yes, the Flash as drawn by Sergio Aragonés," which I thought was such a great nerd slam of like, okay, yeah, we all know who that is. Good stuff.
Cosplay dates back much earlier to science fiction conventions. I can think of many different strains. There was a guy named Eric Hoffman, a film collector who was brought in by Shell to show old films and old horror films. There was the Society for Creative Anachronisms, who were part of the 71 convention, I think. There was STAR, the Star Trek Association for Revival, that came in 73. It was not, you don't belong. It was like, if you possibly can come, come. I think it might have been to attract more people, but also because we weren't sectarian. We didn't see any problem with that. It wasn't spoiling it to have this.
So Richard Alf, he really liked people and unusual people and different odd groups and things, and he wanted to involve everybody in Comic-Con. It was very open and very welcoming to anybody at the time. And so, yeah, there was a guy named Ron Cerns led a group here in San Diego called the Society of the Friends of Hobbits. And Richard contacted them and got them involved, and they were a big help. And the local Society for Creative Anachronism. So they're the people that they're like the medieval times reenactors. Paul Anderson, the great science fiction author, and his daughter Astrid Anderson were very involved in the founding and in the early days of the Society for Creative Anachronism. And Astrid ended up, she was very involved in the letter writing campaign that saved Star Trek and gave it a third season.
And she became kind of a royalty, figure of royalty in her youth. And they did costuming on a medieval scale. They really wanted kind of precise medieval costumes. But they had a lot of people who were writers involved as well, like Catherine Kurtz and so many others.
I can remember these guys walking around in like Viking outfits or medieval warrior outfits. And I remember one of them was standing around at the 71 Comic-Con drinking out of a paper cup. And I said, "Is that mead?" And he said, "No, malt." You know, they obviously stood out. And I don't think that there was necessarily that much overlap. I mean, we allowed them to be part of our group. We thought that our attendees would enjoy their presence, but they weren't necessarily interested in what we were doing.
And they would put on these tourneys at conventions in padded armor and go out and whack each other with these padded swords. And that would become, the whole Tolkien Society would join in on that side of it. And, you know, there was just so much cross connections with culture here. Actors would come in and they would suddenly realize, you know, they can walk around as themselves and hardly be noticed.
Then, of course, there were always the naked or semi-naked women that would enter the masquerade. Have you heard about this?
There used to be this thing in the costume contest called the Most Naked Man and the Most Naked Lady Award. And that was something that went through all the 70s.
It faded out after a while, and I think it was forbidden. There would be statements that would say no nudity, no weapons, things like that at the masquerades. But it was a thing for a while in the 70s to have at least one naked woman come out for the masquerade just in her birthday suit.
Yeah, we did have the clothes required rule in the masquerade, because I know the Equicon in 73 in L.A., one girl was in a masquerade and she wore a jewel on her belly button, and that was all. It was an interesting costume. And we also had one, a rule about sword play on stage, because one sword went flying off the stage, a guy out of a guy's hand, and almost skewered Robert Heinlein, which wouldn't have been good. So we, you know, put in safety precautions.
You have people who are walking around stark naked, and it's okay because they're supposed to be part of the upcoming costume contest. You had massive amounts of alcohol, massive amounts of weed. People were dropping acid right and left.
There's an interesting anecdote about how it works both ways that has been going around for many years. It was told by Jim Shooter, who was for many years the publisher of Marvel Comics, who was down in Little Rock, Arkansas for a comic book convention. And one time he got into an elevator wearing a business suit, because Jim Shooter always wore a nice suit wherever he went. And there was this guy in the elevator wearing flip-flops and cut-off jeans, and he had this big pig on his head.
Foam rubber hog,
because I guess it had something to do with the Arkansas Razorbacks. There was some sort of a football function going on at the hotel at the same time. And he said, "You there with them there funny book people?" And Jim Shooter said, "Well, yes, I am." "Well, that's an awfully funny way for a man to make a living." Or something
damn,
like
damn
that.
Damn silly thing for a grown man to be doing, he says with the hog on his head.
With wearing this hog on his head.
And Jim Shooter said, I looked up at his hog.
And I looked down
at his shorts, and I said, I didn't say a word. I shook my head and got off the elevator.
And are you ready for a program change?
No. Aren't we okay?
Now, isn't it more fun this way, wondering what's going on?
Sure. Okay. Oh, sorry.
We seem to be running into an awful lot of comic material today, and not too much science fiction material today. The 7 o'clock discussion tonight will be...
Star Trek fans were a very much a part of Comic-Con in the early days, with special places in the art show for Star Trek art. There was Star Trek programming on the always on the schedule, area set aside for Star Trek fans to get together and talk. Also, that's not as obvious today. When I look at the early program books for the early comic conventions, there's all kinds of material from Star Trek fandom. And STAR, S-T-A-R, was the Star Trek fan club that acted many chapters around the country. And there was certainly one in San Diego. And the people who were active in STAR were big contributors to what went on at the conventions.
At the 1966 World Science Fiction Convention in Cleveland, there was a bit of a pop culture spin to it in that two different television groups came to promote their upcoming science fiction TV shows. And the first case was a gentleman who came out and said, "You're all going to want to buy color television sets because our show is so wonderful. Oh my gosh, this is just the most fantastic thing in the world. Oh, 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 oh." And it was Time Tunnel.
Two American scientists are lost in the swirling maze of past and future ages during the first experiments on America's greatest and most secret project, the Time Tunnel.
The audience was, to put it mildly, unimpressed. Gene Roddenberry then, I think observing what was going on, stood up and said, "I know you guys know all about science fiction. I'm so grateful that you let me come to show you what I've done. I hope you enjoy it."
There are hazards that beset the Enterprise and its crew on board ship and on alien planets.
And we loved it. And it was Star Trek. The next year, Star Trek had been so influential, there was disdain from the hardcore, "I read science fiction, I don't go to movies and television shows," very contemptuous about Star Trek, that it wasn't true science. It somehow didn't meet their high standards.
What I'm talking about right now, when I say science fiction is dying, and despite Greg's saying that no, it isn't, it's better than ever, it's bigger than ever, I'm going to say it's not necessarily better than ever, it's bigger than ever, and it's being more and more and more and more accepted and being taken into the mainstream of literature, and science fiction as a separate branch of literature is dying. It will, in time, be taken as much for granted as any other damn piece of literature. It'll still be popular, it'll still have people who read nothing but. However, as a group, will we exist, or will we be as numerous as the people who read Rocky Lane?
Rocky Lane?
Rocky
Star
Lane?
Rocky Lane. Trekkies are around like fleas.
Right. I say science fiction is dying because it will be so popular that as a separate entity...
And Bijo Trimble stood up in front of that audience at one point and said, "How dare you? I have listened to years for you people griping that there weren't enough girls. Now here they are, and you're mocking what brought them in." And I was among those applauding what she said. I was an old hand in science fiction and absolutely appreciated everything Roddenberry did.
A lot of times those fans, they were TV fans. They weren't really science fiction readers. And so for an old science fiction fan, I'm talking about myself as an old science fiction fan when I was 17. For a old style science fiction reader, you're reading Doc Smith and Robert Heinlein and that sort of thing, the Star Trek fandom seemed a little distant to me because their connection was with a television program and not this deeper thing. But I would not take away from their enjoyment and their love for Star Trek. And I have continued to follow all the franchises. I'm a bore among my friends talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is the greatest of all the Star Trek programs.
Star Trekkies can have a ball. Captain Kirk and Dr. Spock are big as life. And the rest of the crew abounds on buttons, magazines, newspapers, even books.
The younger fans just went for it. Those of us who are a little older sort of went, well, let's see how this works out. Because, let's face it, we had been promised a great show in Lost in Space, and it suddenly devolved into a kiddie show.
Does not compute. Does not compute. Danger, Will Robinson, danger.
Well, Irwin Allen created these kids' TV shows with fabulous special effects. If you take a look at the effects of Lost in Space, they're much better than Star Trek at that point. The sets are much more expensive looking. Star Trek sets are quite wonderful from our perspective today, but they're pretty rudimentary compared to what they were doing with Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and Lost in Space and Time Tunnel and all that kind of stuff. Irwin Allen was spending huge amounts of money on special effects. Star Trek was trying to avoid that. But the main thing that Roddenberry got correct was the characters. The characters are the most important part. And their interactions, hiring the right actors, and they were brilliantly cast, I think, and the hiring the right writers. I think Dorothy Fontana, one of my favorites, because I think she actually helped create the character of Spock. You know, and then you had other writers being brought in, science fiction writers. Paul Anderson went in and pitched, but they didn't like his idea because he really wanted to do Lieutenant Uhura. He thought she was a fabulous character, but they didn't think she was quite ready for it. So he didn't get a chance, but Theodore Sturgeon did. And Theodore Sturgeon did the opening episode of the second season. It was called Amok Time, and it brought in T'Pring and T'Pau and all these Vulcan women, and they were fabulous. And, you know, the casting there was great as well because one of them was the widow of Peter Lorre. And that chance to go to that world and see it from its inside and to watch it through Spock's eyes as he's going through this torment of the mating season for Vulcan, that was huge for fandom. It was really huge because suddenly you had all of these people who would eventually, you know, kind of think of themselves as being trans or, you know, not quite within the binary systems. They could be given a sense of, oh, this story is about us.
In the 60s, we're a child of that era, and we were very optimistic and expected. We grew up in rising prosperity, and so we expected vast open vistas, and that in our lives we would see great changes and wonderful things. And Star Trek represents that, an optimistic, and Ray Bradbury and his writings, Arthur C. Clarke and his visionary material. We went back to guys like old Alf Stapleton, the British philosopher who wrote four profound science fiction books imagining a history of the solar system and a history of the universes. And this kind of stuff all fed our expectations of as boomers and what we thought. And then, of course, reality of war, poverty, and inequality, it reared their head.
So I grew up with fantasy, and then in 1966, this thing called Star Trek came along, and I fell hopelessly in love with that and started writing to pen pals all over the world at the time the show was on the air. So during the late 60s, when it was still on the air, I was writing to, I think, 350 pen friends around the globe at the time. That was really the precursor of meeting up with other fans at San Diego State when I went out there in 70 and 71. And we started getting together, and eventually we had a costume party at my parents' house that became Star San Diego in 72. And they were fine with that. They loved it. Church people, not so much. You had a hard time explaining any of it to them. And some of the relatives just didn't get it. This thought, you're crazy. You know, what are you getting involved in this strange stuff for? And some of them would outright think you were getting involved in some satanic cult. I mean, seriously, they did. But for the most part, the family was very cool. So then from there, meeting Comic-Con committee members and set up a Star Trek exhibit at Comic-Con in 73 and 4.
When I went out to UCSD as a student in the fall of 1969, I was a history major, and one of the early Comic-Con people, Richard Butner, was in some of my classes, and we discovered a mutual interest. We went to Comic-Con first time in 1972, and that's how both of us eventually ended up on the Comic-Con committee. I found out about STAR through Richard, as a matter of fact.
STAR stood for Star Trek Association for Revival. Fandoms sprang up all over the place, and STAR was just one of the major fan clubs and were quite active. This wasn't easy by mail instead of by computer, but most people managed it.
Bijo also was the one who got the letter writing campaign going that Astrid Anderson helped out on. After two seasons, they were going to cancel Star Trek, and so they got a commitment that if they could get 1 million letters sent in asking for it to be continued, they would give it another third season. So Bijo Trimble headed up a group that actually organized this letter writing campaign, and they succeeded in getting the 1 million letters sent in. And so the network or studio, Desilu or whatever, they actually did a third season of Star Trek, which I understand is one of the things that allowed it to go into syndication. And that's sort of like the rest is history, because that's how possibly most people actually became familiar with Star Trek, was through the reruns.
We mailed at least 25,000 letters, and then, by the way, postage paid for by donations from fans. And we would say, write a letter, and then ask 10 friends to write a letter. They write letters and ask 10 friends to write letters, and so on and so on. And that's what happened.
Star Trek was certainly a major influence on all of us. I think, you know, we all watched Star Trek, and we're all disappointed by the third season when that happened as well, because it was just didn't quite have the same feel as seasons 1 and 2 had. But the series had come to an end by the time that Comic-Con got started, but it was really the beginning of Star Trek fandom.
Well, there wasn't technically a real Star Trek fandom before the letter writing campaign. We were a loose group of individuals, and occasionally in various places, the fans would get together, but that was about it. Nobody really recognized a club per se. Afterwards, when the club started sort of springing up, you had your choice of a whole bunch of things, either nationwide or local clubs, and it went on from there.
Again, this is some of the prehistory of Comic-Con, because this is stuff that happened before Comic-Con got started. And as I recall, there actually was a bunch of students from Caltech, you know, who marched on the studios and said, save Star Trek, we want to keep this going. And so it was one of the first cases where there was kind of a crowdsourced influence on popular culture.
I think this was probably the first time that fans, the public, had gotten a network to renew a TV show.
At some of the meetings, I saw the start of fandom. People like Bijo Trimble, she came to one of our meetings and wrote, she'd written the Star Trek Concordance. I know there's an excitement among the people there, because they said, oh, Bijo Trimble's coming. Bijo Trimble's coming.
Again, a major influence in the early years of Comic-Con, the fact that she showed up and played a regular role, interacted so much with people like Greg Bear and so on, and helped us to establish our science fiction cred as not just a comic book convention, but someplace that was also a place where science fiction writers could come as well. So it's interesting to see those connections between what's happening in the late 60s with the beginning of really fandom for a comic book and science fiction, showing its influence not just in the printed word, but also having its influence on in this case, the television world as well, and by, later on by extension to the world of film also.
Starr was asked to set up an exhibit, and 73 was at the Sheraton, and Walter Kame was our guest, and Dorothy Fontana. And that went over very well. We had a ball, and we came in Star Trek costumes, and the news media would come, and they would always focus on the Star Trek costumes because they were the most colorful outfits instead of the comic book costumes, some of which were colorful too. But for some reason, Star Trek, being such a big fandom at the time, kind of got all the media attention.
Certainly we didn't want this to be just a Star Trek convention. And it seemed like much, from my science fiction perspective, it seemed to be much too focused on one specific show. In fact, a show that was no longer in production. But I think there's also a positive aspect to that, too, because it also helped swell the ranks of the actual convention itself.
To be honest, we made fun of them. They actually did have a stamp-out Star Trek buttons that we'd hand out just to get under people's skin a little bit. You guys are all upset because Star Trek has been canceled, and you'd like to bring it back on there, but it hasn't happened. But, you know, there's another great fantasy series that was on TV and was canceled, which actually ran longer than Star Trek, which was Gilligan's Island.
Bob Denver played Gilligan, the first mate on the boat, and he was always kind of an eternal screw-up. But he would wear this like red shirt and had this funny little sailor's cap. They thought it'd be funny to go to the masquerade at the Comic-Con dressed as Gillies. You know, and they were supposedly obsessive fans of Gilligan's Island who wanted the show to be brought back, just like the Trekkies, you know, so they were just spoofing the Trekkies. So they all got like identical, like red shirts and the white sailor's cap, and they went on stage together. And there's probably half a dozen of them stood there and sang the Gilligan's Island theme.
You got to understand, a lot of the convention was about making fun of people. And as much as we absorbed the Star Trekkies, the Trekkies we called them, we called them Trekkies because they insisted on being called Trekkers.
They didn't really like the word Trekkies. I think they preferred the word Trekkers. I got called out for calling them Trekkies once. I think we accepted it after time. I says, I'm a Trekkie. Doesn't matter. Call me, you know, just call me when there's a show on.
When I wrote a piece for the LA Times about the, what was it, 25th anniversary of Trek, for example, I called it the McDonald's of science fiction. It's what the public expects and knows, and will always get the same thing. And that's why fast food made such enormous impact on American life.
Science fiction fans and comics fans are inveterate spoofers. And if they think something's being taken too seriously, they're going to spoof the blazes out of it. You can get all upset about that if you want to, but I, frankly, have got a sense of humor that accepts kind of thing. And I'm perfectly willing to have somebody kid the socks off something. Even if I feel passionately about it, it's still fun.
My little town, Medford, Oregon, which I live nearby, has the distinction of kind of being the beginning of the Trekkies. In Medford, Oregon, 1967, Leonard Nimoy comes to do an appearance. And he comes as Spock in the outfit with the ears. The cops thought they planned on maybe a couple hundred people. I think they had something like 2,000 people. And they were like, what? Because the show wasn't that well rated. But this gave the creators of the show, the studio, the network of like, wait a minute, something's going on here. So I'm kind of proud to be part of the origins of that, my home state.
When you give a group of kids the opportunity to meet and hang out with their heroes, they're going to make it the best it can be. There's not one person involved in birthing the con who can't say they're a profoundly different person today than who they were before they joined our team.
One of the many great joys of Comic-Con is the number of people who built their careers there. They may have come as amateurs at first. Some of them walked in with art samples and walked out with a career their first visit. You know, everybody comes to Comic-Con with some goal. Some people just want to find that one missing issue of Iron Man they don't have. And some people come because they want to meet certain celebrities and get an autograph or a selfie photo. And some people come because they want to make contact. They want to know more about the comics. These are the people I frequently see in panels that I host about how the books are done and how they're made and what goes into designing a good cover, what goes into writing a good story. And there are people who come there because they want to make friends, and there are people who come because they just want to touch that industry.
I think that's the wonderful thing about Comic-Con. It is a cross-pollination area where people who are coming up in their career can truly meet and network and just share admiration for people who inspired them in their careers. And so that sort of cycle of creativity is something that you don't get in person a lot. There's a lot of Hollywood parties, but that's a whole different crowd. When you're a geek creator, it's so wonderful to have an artist be able to meet an actor that they love, or a costume designer, meet a director, or any illustrator. So it is a place where a lot of geek interests all combine, and I'm sure that a lot of cool projects have come out of that.
Being part of the San Diego Comic-Con from the beginning was one of the most, if not the most, decisive things in my entire life. I became a writer, I became a songwriter, I became a journalist, I've had radio shows, I've written books. All of that didn't seem like something fantastic. And it was because of these early interactions that I have and the great kindness that people like Jack Kirby and George Clayton Johnson showed me. So Comic-Con changed my life. I'm eternally grateful to it.
Comic-Con actually, and the comic industry, made me what I am today. I get to work at a theme park and create seasonal attractions to entertain thousands of people because as a child, I read too many comic books.
Today, I'm on the physics faculty at the University of California, Santa Barbara. My father was a mechanical engineer working for Convair. And so that science and science fiction stuff really blended together, I think, in a fairly seamless fashion. I guess the main moral I derive from this is, if there's something you can imagine doing, just go out and do it. And it doesn't matter whether it's in comic books, whether it's in finance, whether it's in science, what have you. If there's something completely wacky that you can think about doing, just try it. If a bunch of kids just barely into puberty can work together with adult supervision and make all this stuff happen, I figure pretty much anybody can do it.
I think that Comic-Con, A, helped to give the industry of Hollywood and the comic book industry a way to market and to make its appeal to the general public very direct and not filtered through any prejudice possible. But more than that, if you went to Comic-Con, you're with people that had the same imaginative view of the universe, and it exponentially sort of grew. It became respectable. The idea that comics would stunt your growth or science fiction would keep you from reading real books, this idea dissipated with time, and I'm sure that Comic-Con had a hand in making it respectable and making it even a healthy and beneficial thing to make part of American and international culture.
It's gone so far, it's just inconceivable. And I'm just glad I'm around to see this. It's, can't even express how flabbergasted I am.
Comic-Con has been absorbed by the larger mainstream to absolutely say the least, man. It is the mainstream at this point. You know, it's no longer some fringe event for people that, we like movies and comic books and stuff like that. Everybody knows it. You don't get to 200,000 attendees with just the fan base. You know, that's looky-loos. There's people like, I hear you can walk the floor and you can see panels and stuff like that. So it's become much bigger than I think the founders intended, and probably will continue to grow and maintain, a rightful place at the center of all things pop culture.
To take all these people that are spread out and they all have their interests in different things like Star Trek or comic books, who may be isolated from other people with similar interests, and it would bring them all to the same place, and they'd, instead of being the nerd, then they're like everyone else. They see all these people with common interests and they get together, and then I think those connections would go beyond. And that's probably one of the reasons it's grown so much over the years, is because there are lots of people that share their interests, and Comic-Con, brought them together.
Our love for comics and fantasy was validated.
I think for me, it was just finding my people. And it was a place where I felt safe and not weird.
You know, there is a diagram of the history of scientific evolution. If you look at the chart basically is virtually a flat line across, you know, thousands of years from the start to about 150 years ago, to where it almost makes a vertical climb. It's amazing to watch. And I think comic book fandom and Comic-Con is very much like that. You know, we were all in our little niche, those of us who love the medium and what it could bring to us. And then one day, especially once the San Diego Con started to grow and move to the convention center where there was more room, some PR guy at some film studio went, you know, maybe we can pitch our new movie to that audience. They're almost a certainty that at least the majority of them want to see it, and word of mouth will get around and we'll see what we can do. And it worked. And suddenly it became not quite so Comic-Con.
I think what geeks have finally come to realize is that they rule the roost. They run the show. Geeks are running Hollywood now, so that's why Marvel is doing quite well. And many thanks to the fans for their support, because if they didn't crowd into the San Diego Comic-Con, my kids would not have gone to a college that they dropped out of.
Thank you for journeying with me once more to the early days of the San Diego Comic-Con. I'm Brink Stevens, and I hope you'll continue tumbling down the rabbit hole on our next episode, where we'll explore just what it took to put the con together, back when none of us had any idea what the hell we were doing. Comic-Con Begins is a Sirius XM original podcast, created and directed by Matthew Klickstein, executive produced by Rob Schulte, written and produced by Matthew Klickstein, Rob Schulte, and Christopher Tyler. Edited by Rob Schulte and Christopher Tyler. Mixed by James Bilodeau. Original music composed by Max DiVincenzo. Produced by Fox Tracks Music. With special liaison to SiriusXM, Brannon Getchess, and historical consultant Wendy All. Archival material and additional research provided by Mike Towery and his Comic-Con Memories website, Alan Light's 1975 Comic-Con recordings, Jackie Estrada and Comic-Con's 40th anniversary souvenir book, Pamela Jackson and San Diego State University's Comic-Con Kids Project, Maureen Cavanaugh at San Diego's KPBS, Mark Evanier, Scott Shaw, Barry Alfonso, Bill Lund, Erin Hanna, and her book Only at Comic-Con, the works of Bill Shelley, and me, your host, Brink Stevens. We obviously had many other people working tirelessly on this project behind the scenes, not to mention our nearly 100 contributing interviewees, too large in number to list here. So we ask you to take a moment to check out the fuller list of credits in the episode description. Thank you kindly. Keep listening. And from all of us at Comic-Con Begins, stay fantastic. Bye now.